It's Friday, July 1st, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today, we're talking about new ways to fight spam using a term called graylisting with the author of the white paper, Evan Harris. We'll be speaking about that in a few minutes. Of course, now, it is time, once again, like it is every week, for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on our program, we're speaking with the author of a white paper called Graylisting, Evan Harris, all about the next step in spam control. The next step in spam control wars. We implemented it recently on the Geek Speak server, and our mail spam has decreased severely. So we got him on to talk about how this technology, this way of doing spam fighting works. Of course, during the second half of the show, I'll welcome your conversation, your phone numbers. Let's try this one more time. During the second half of the show, in about 20 minutes, I'll welcome you to call us in or email us in and ask us questions or comments about technology, computers, the world. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. In the air with me are geeks, Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland, and Miles Elam. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Hello.
Before we get into our discussion on spam control technologies or procedures and Miles' wonderful implementation of said, we're going to do some geek news. I'm going to start today with Drew. Hi, Drew.
Good morning, Lyle. So, NASA researchers have discovered a planet with the largest solid core. So, a couple of weeks ago, we had another planetary discovery, but this one is different because it's an enormous, dense core. It's 70 times more massive than the Earth, and it orbits a sun-like star. It's roughly about equal in mass to Saturn in our own solar system, but it's significantly smaller in diameter. It's denser. It takes 2 3/4 of a day to circle around the star, and the atmosphere is around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's very hot. So the cool thing for scientists about this planet is that it's evidence of a theory on how planets are formed. They have two theories, core accretion and gravitational instability. So the core accretion means you've got a little ice chunk orbiting around and gravity gradually conglomerates other pieces onto it and it grows into a planet. And then the flip side of that, or the opposite side of the spectrum, is that the gravitational instability means a dense cloud collapses and forms sort of a dust ball, which then has a gravitational mass and attracts more dust. So this planet is proof of one or the other. They haven't decided which. It's kind of a you can throw your hands up in the air as to which way it got there, but it's proof that there are more and more planets out there. We just haven't seen them yet. It's pretty cool.
Thank you, Drew, very much for that. Sean, hi.
Hi. So kind of in the same vein here, space, the final frontier. NASA sent their deep impact projectile off. Remember that?
Yeah.
About the size of a washing machine, traveling at 22,000 miles an hour towards a 4-mile-wide comet. It will hit on July 3rd.
Ooh, talk about fireworks.
It'll be like a bug hitting the windshield of an 18-wheeler.
Oh, July 3rd, like tomorrow?
Or as in 2 days from now.
They expect it'll slow the comet down by 5/10,000ths of a millimeter per second. And over the next 5 years, it will change the trajectory of the comet by about 100 meters.
Over 5 years.
But
basically has no effect.
A camera off the impactor will separate and film the whole thing in various different, you know, lights. And hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about what comets are made of. Want to find out more, go to Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Deep Impact website. That's deepimpact.jpl.nasa.gov.
Thanks. Mr. Elam, Miles, hi, my new hero. What's up?
Pittsburgh Safar Center for Resuscitation Research has developed a technique they've created zombie dogs.
What?
Drained a subject's, in this case a group of dogs, drained a subject's veins of blood and filled with this ice-cold salt solution.
What?
The animals had stopped breathing. They had no heartbeat and no brain activity. They were considered scientifically dead for hours. Were then brought back to life. Their blood was reintroduced into their body, and they have no signs of any damage.
Wait.
Brain damage.
No way.
They were brought back to life by their normal blood coming back, not this weird salt cold thing.
Right.
Did they?
So
now,
they drained
the. So this is kind of like a cold
solution.
Sleep type of thing.
Yes. It's.
Did they? Did they have memories? Still.
Well,
yeah, they had no perceivable brain damage. When they were testing through there, the dog seemed fine after doing this.
You know, I thought this story was going to be... I mean, that's pretty still nasty doing weird research on dogs because, you know, we have such an affiliation for dogs. But still, it's pretty... I mean, it's creepily neat, I guess. I wouldn't call them zombies, though. I mean, they're
right.
They're mammals
well,
again.
They're reanimated dead.
Oh.
Okay, you're right.
So how long were they sleeping for? Or out of
for,
it?
For... I don't have an exact time, but it's a few hours.
Wow.
But they were in a state of hyperthermia.
That's really cool.
And they were brought back by raising their body temperature, giving them 100% oxygen, and applying electric shocks to restart their hearts.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that kind of creepy story.
Wow.
No kidding.
Science is cool.
Drew Meyer, back to you.
So there's an interesting interview that was done with a guy between two... Well, it was done with a guy named Eric Raymond, who's one of the principal open source gurus in the community for Linux. And he's talking about some of the licensing issues, saying that some of the licensing, that the way it's traditionally been done using something called the GPL, which is a type of license, maybe it's getting past that. It's really not helping grow the community anymore. And so the big picture here is that the way open source software is licensed and distributed is difficult. And it slows down adoption because people are concerned that if they make changes, everyone's going to piggyback on their changes for free, which is essentially the concept behind the GPL. And so to have a high-profile person like this come out and criticize the GPL is sort of a big deal in the Linux community.
Definitely. Where do you think it's going to go from here, Drew? What's your take on it?
Well, the GPL has gotten us... I don't know if it's a good thing or not. It's really a matter of principle, how firmly you believe in that information wants to be free and that software should be available to anyone who needs to use it. And then on the other side of that, you have sort of a commercial take on things that I want to own the creativity that I generate. And I need to protect that by having a software license that's restrictive. And so that's, you know, we see that all over the place in music, in art, in most electronic venues today. And that argument is still being had everywhere.
Yeah, this is a really interesting argument, of course, about intellectual property, if you want to use that term, which a lot of people actually hate the term because there's no property to intellect. In any case, I think we're going to do next week's Geek Speak, all about IP.
Oh, great.
And
perfect.
I look forward to that. I hope you all as well. All right, we're going to go on to Sean.
Oh, me,
Sean.
Okay, this is pretty crazy. There's this new device that the Los Angeles Police Department has employed called Mobile Plate Hunter 900 from Remington LSAG Law Enforcement Systems. It uses Italian character recognition software that's employed by their post office. To read license plates of cars. So it's this tiered, large foot-long aluminum teardrop bolted to the patrol car's light bar. And with it, with these two infrared cameras, they can read between 500 and 800 plates, license plates, per hour as they drive by the cars parked on the streets. In one night, over the course of one night, they queried more than 12,000 license plates, recovered 7 stolen cars that resulted in 3 arrests.
Wow. Just using cameras and databases. Creepy. I mean, to some degree, I guess it's okay, but there's also this whole idea of privacy, but maybe not since the license number is obviously not a private thing.
Right.
But it is kind of the Big Brother thing that, you know, it's kind of scary in some ways. I got to say that I work at UCSC, and the parking situation up there is that you have to buy a fee, you have to do all this stuff, and you get a ticket, really severe ticket, if you mess up on something like forget to put your little placard up or don't bring it with you that day. And it's so frustrating because, of course, the people that walk around, they've got electronic pieces of equipment. They're not scanning all the license plates. You'd think that they just scan all the license plates. They come to the campus, you get charged while you're there, and when you leave, it gets removed. I mean, how convenient would that be?
Right.
You know? In any case, thank you for that
and
story about law enforcement.
In UK, it looks like they're having problems with spray-on mud. I guess SUV owners look like they've been in the mud.
Sure.
You can actually buy cans of spray-on mud to spray it on your car. Except they're spraying it on their license plate so they can speed and not get targeted or whatever.
Sneaky English.
So I don't know, maybe more people will employ spray-on mud to battle the Mobile Plate Hunter 900. I don't know.
Just this whole spray-on mud thing. You know, I heard about it a couple days ago, and one of you sent me a link. It's just so, it's so foul to me, the idea that you'd buy fake mud to impress people that you use your SUV in a way that, anyway, it's so
strange.
Frustrating. I think it's actually Miles' turn. Miles?
Yes. Verizon Wireless is adopting a new spec. It's called CDMA 1X EVDO. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, say that three times fast.
Code Division Multiple Access CDMA, like for CDMA phones. And
I was,
then
I was kidding.
EVDO, it's Evolution Data Only.
What does it do?
What it does is you buy a card, like a PC card, you put it into a Windows machine or with a little tweaking Mac OS X, and it gives you data access without having to wait for a Wi-Fi hotspot. It's just anywhere you have cellular access.
Is it fast? Because isn't that the problem with current cellular modems?
Right. What it can do is
so you're basically
400
using
to 700 kilobits per second downstream, 100 kilobits upstream.
So that's wow. That's pretty good.
Reasonable.
So, I mean, it's not bad.
Yeah. It's not as fast as having like a home network at the same time or home DSL.
Well, it's faster than dial-up. But
yeah.
Is this thing, I mean, you just still have to be paying for your service time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's... yes, and
yeah.
It's kind of pricey. It's
right.
One of those, if you need it, you can afford it.
Right.
you...
All right, thank you very much, Miles. We're going to do just one more. Drew, you seemed interested in doing one more, and we're going to get to our topic, which is spam fighting. Drew, go ahead.
This is amazing. A 646-pound catfish was pulled out of the Mekong River. Okay, 646 pounds is a behemoth. It's the largest on record since 1981. It's as big as a grizzly bear, 646 pounds. There's a picture here. This thing is as big as two guys. They can't hold it up. They've got it. They're crouched over it on the ground. It looks like it could easily swallow a person. It's insane. 6 feet long is the average for a lart for giantism in fish, is what National Geographic says. And this is the current record holder. Can you believe that? 646 pounds, in case you didn't get that the first
time. What's the
looks
length?
Like the looks like the size of a grizzly bear.
It's this picture is unbelievable. The length of this precise one, I do not have
right,
in this article.
Well, send
looks
the
about
URL
8 or 9 feet.
Send the URL to the Geeks, and we'll put it up on the website. Got to do that, of course. Okay, you're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, and Drew Meyer, and we just did the news, and we're now going to go on to something that Miles brought to the attention of the Geeks 2 days ago. Spam fighting is a there's a whole variety of ways to fight spam. Most of it involves looking at the messages and filtering them. And there's a whole process of why spam is so cheap to do and therefore why it's so prevalent. And we're going to talk all about that. We're also going to talk about, we're inviting Evan Harris on right now. He's the author of The Next Step in Spam Control War, Gray Listing. Evan, thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem.
So, Evan, tell us what gray listing is.
Gray listing is a method in combating the current crop of spam sending software that adopts a strategy of trying to send as much spam as possible as quickly as possible. It adopts the idea that is within the SMTP RFCs of denying a connection the first time it tries, and because most spam software will never retry sending a mail message again, it will then block that spam, even though any other correctly configured mail server will retry on an occasional basis, and the message will eventually get through.
So the basic idea is these spam bots, when you talk about spam bots, you're talking about a computer basically just is dedicated solely to sending out spam.
Pretty much, though nowadays it's usually also their distributed networks that are basically backdoored by viruses. And a spam sending bot is installed on unknowing end users' computers, and the people that control these networks of spam bots are the majority of where the spam comes from these days.
Okay, so you're talking about the methodology of sending spam.
Yes.
Is to take over innocent people's computers, make them be sending spam in the background, and the person's never even aware that they're doing it.
That's correct.
Now, this is a case when someone says, well, I've got some kind of I've got something on my system, some kind of virus, because my machine is really slowed down. Normally it's slowed down, and network speed is slowed down because it's sending out mass amounts of email.
That's exactly right.
Okay, but a network of that sort, each one of those computers gets a list of email addresses to send messages to.
That's true.
And it keeps on downloading new email lists to send new messages to and formats them all special, trying to get through filters and everything.
Yes.
So the idea of that network is it doesn't have a lot of redundancy built into it. It's kind of an ad hoc, messy, very illegal environment.
Yes, basically the people who code the software to do these things, and it's not necessarily all just those, because there are quite a few end-user applications. I mean, one computer can send an awful lot of mail, you know, if it has a high-speed connection.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even people that want to be, who think of themselves as somewhat legitimate, can purchase software that will just go and blast through a million email addresses as fast as possible, not using these networks, which are obviously illegal, but it still creates just as much of a problem.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not uncommon for, like, even small businesses to have some kind of sending mail for their email lists. They send messages out. I have set up situations in which, you know, they'll have, like, a FileMaker database, for example, that's supposed to send mail out to the list of people about
Absolutely.
Certain updates. But normally those systems connect to the local network provider's SMTP server, which is a normally multiple machines that are kind of handling that heavy load of sending and receiving email.
In a lot of cases, yes, that's true. Depending on the size of the organization, sometimes it's worth maintaining your own mail server. But for most end users, they're going to want to route through their ISP's mail server because they aren't online all the time in some cases, or they don't want their system to be doing that, or they don't have the software installed to do that, and it's just a lot easier and safer to route it through your upstream ISP.
Right. Okay. So why does this – so the basic – let me try to simplify this to some degree. The idea being these people that are sending spam are doing it such in a way that they want to spit out as much spam as possible in a fast amount of time. They don't have a big redundant system built up to do it. So what they do is they just get a list of emails and just send through a message and try sending a message to each one of those emails. Some of them get rejected and some of them get accepted, but they just keep going.
That's right.
And then they never really repeat that message and try to go through that cycle again. But normal email systems, what they'll do is if I send a message to Miles over here, when I send the email message out, it goes to a server, and the server tries to send it to Miles. And then if there's some kind of delayed response of, I can't deal with this right now, I'm too busy, it'll try again a little bit later.
That's right. If for people who aren't aware of the SMTP specs, there are several different levels of error messages that a server can respond to a client who's trying to do something on the mail server. One of them is a temporary failure, or there's actually a class of messages that is a temporary failure, which means, go away, I'm too busy right now, come back later. And these are the messages that graylisting takes advantage of in telling a spammer to go away because I haven't seen you before, and after some small period of time, if they reconnect and retry to send their message, they'll get through.
So the basic idea, what you do then in this format is you receive the message, you get the message, you say, I'm sorry, I don't know who you are, you reject it out of hand, but you record some information about that message and then hold that in the database. And then 10 or 15 minutes later and onward for a day, if that same message is sent again, you'll say, oh, that's something I recognize, you tried twice, therefore I'll accept it.
That's correct.
Okay. Miles, you implemented this a day and a half ago.
Right.
How did you implement it on our server, in loose terms?
Well, actually, I can do it in very specific terms. It was ridiculously easy because I was using the Debian Linux distribution. I was able to simply say apt-get install PostGray. PostGray is a gray listing software for PostFix,
okay.
PostFix mailer. And I went in and said, enable this, and off it went. I really didn't have to do much. That was something I really loved about this about the system, was that it's administrator very light. Like, I don't have to do anything else.
Let me just talk about my spam. I get about 80 to 100 spam messages a day on my...
Or at least you used to.
Yeah. And normally a lot of those are caught by an algorithm, a Bayesian filter algorithm of spam assassin, and they're put in a special folder. But I still go in there and I check them because it's possible that someone I haven't heard from a long time or something looks like a spam message. So it gets held in there, and I look through it every once in a while and delete it. And I also get some that come through, and my local email client tags it as spam and puts it in keeps it in one place, but it kind of learns as well. So there's two levels of spam detection, and those combined regularly for me are about 100 a day. Maybe more than that. Sometimes it's heavier load. So a night and a half ago.
I enabled this. And I get an email from Lyle the next day saying, I have zero spam emails.
Basically,
in my
it's all dropped. I've gotten a total of 3 spam in a day and a half, which is an excessive drop. And I haven't gotten any complaints about messages that I haven't gotten.
Right.
Though it's possible that some lists. Oh, and also one of those.
My grand total now is 4.
One of those spams that I did get was actually a pseudo legitimate message group thing. Something I didn't want. It was tagging as spam in my client, so if I thought it was spam, but they did have a realistic removal process. So it wasn't even a bad message.
So, Mr. Evan Harris, thank you on behalf of the Geekspeak crew.
Well, you're very welcome.
Amazing way of doing things. Okay, so the big thing about this, though, is a lot of this battle, if you will, is like the spam people figure out a way of doing something, and then people figure out a way of fighting it, and then the spam people come back and figure a way to get around it. That we see that a lot in algorithmic ideas. Like, if you have a certain word in your, you know, if you have refinance in the subject line, I never want to see it because I know it's a spam. But what happens is they start spelling things differently, and they start trying to fight
right.
that.
Finance with a 1
so,
instead of an I.
Right, exactly. So
Viagra with a 1.
How, Evan Harris, how will this react as, I mean, how long, you wrote this white paper in 2003.
That's right.
Have they figured out how to combat it yet?
To tell you the truth, I expected that this particular method of combating spam would not be very effective by itself for very long. And the reason why is because, really, like you were saying, it really is an arms race in the spam war. You know, the spammers, you know, do an enhancement so they can get more mail through, and, you know, the anti-spam people write better software or better algorithms or, you know, implement better word filters to be able to block the stuff out again. And then, you know, it just keeps going back and forth.
So you assume that it was just a matter of time?
I figured, yeah, because it's a very simple way to overcome it. The only thing that a spammer has to do to overcome graylisting without any additional support is to behave like an RFC-compliant mail server.
You mean you have to follow the rules?
That's right.
And it's easy to follow the rules to some degree.
It's very easy to follow the rules, and it wouldn't take them very much more effort at all. The thing is they just aren't willing to go to the effort because, I mean, there's already so many mail recipients that they're trying to deliver to that are just never receiving their mail. I mean, when I was developing the idea, I was sitting tracking spam, trying to figure out what was going on, and what I found is that they didn't seem to care about bounces, you know, which is when they try to deliver to somebody whose account no longer exists or is unavailable for some reason.
Well, I think they're getting paid by the number of email addresses they have.
That's
how many
right.
they're sending out.
The only metric that they have for the customers is to tell you how many people they will send to. Then what you measure is the response rate. But the response rate is keyed off of the material that they're trying to advertise. So the problem is that there's not really any good way for the people who are employing the spammers to get any kind of performance metric on how well they are delivering their message.
Right.
Right.
So it doesn't matter a bit to the spammer if 50,000 messages, you know, get bounced right away because, hey, he tried to deliver to 50,000 accounts.
And that's what he's getting paid for.
And there's no way for whoever's paying him to verify that he sent to those 50,000 accounts, you know?
Right.
Right.
Well, there probably could be a way, but they're not going to go through the effort to do that.
Pretty much. That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, it's also because it's so cheap. I mean, that's the big thing about spamming. The reason why you see so much of it is it's easy and simple and cheap to do.
It is.
Yeah. At the same time, what I thought would be useful is graylisting along with my use, for example, of a real-time black hole list or a DNS blacklist.
Absolutely, and actually in the white paper I suggest that it is much better used if you use it in concert with another method of blocking spam like that. Because really, even if the spammers had changed their software to become, you know, RFC compliant and were following the rules, graylisting would still be of benefit because it gives you a time window when you can detect that a server is behaving in a spamming, you know, method of operation and be able to block it before it actually gets to be able to deliver any mail to you.
Right. So
right.
On the first try, it's going like, who is this guy?
That's
and
right.
then the next time, it's, I know who you are. You, I don't like you.
That's right. And when you use it in concert with some of the other DNS-based blacklists, it's even more effective, because the people that report spam, all the people that aren't implementing graylisting will get the spam, report the source, and then it will be in the list by the time the spammer comes around to try and redeliver to you, and it even though graylisting would pass it, the blacklist would block it.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxel. We're talking about spam fighting. We'll be back in just a moment with Evan Harris, talking all about the newest and greatest, well, 3 years old but still working, 2 years old, still working, graylisting and how it works, and also other ways to combat spam. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can use the Internet, visit geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us. Drew Meyer is going to be leaving us now, but we'll stay with the rest of the geeks, including our guest. Thank you, Drew, for joining us.
Thank you, and shout out to all my organic farmer friends out there.
All right. And, of course, you're listening to Geek Speak. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are open now. 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Let's keep it, the messages today, about email and spam if you can. That would be wonderful.
This week on This American Life, the story of a couple who were unhappy for 27 years. He had a temper. She never really loved him. And then they split up, divorced. And then, 2 years after that, to everybody's surprise, especially their grown children, they fell in love and married each other again. And everything this time was different. How that could possibly be, this week.
On This American Live, Sunday at 10 on KUSP.
You are listening to KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, KDBH. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland. We just said goodbye to Drew Meyer. And, of course, Miles Elam. We have our guest, Evan Harris. We're talking about spam control, and you're welcome to join the conversation. I'll give you the numbers in just a second. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise, providing Internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, and MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise membership is available online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. If you'd like to call in now to talk to us about spam, viruses, email problems, the phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or, of course, you can use the Internet. Visit geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. We have a guest with us, Evan Harris, who wrote a wonderful white paper on graylisting. We're going to take a call right now, start taking the calls right now that you're to some degree lining up. First, we're going to take Gene from Santa Cruz. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm interested in what the current state of the caller ID phenomena for spam. Now, I had understood that if we were able to immediately identify any incoming email, it would really cut down the numbers in the sense that now that I have caller ID that doesn't allow anyone that doesn't give up their caller ID to get through, I only get a couple of calls where I used to get many of them a day.
There is that type of technology in place. It's normally through service providers that filter your email for you. So they take care of the incoming email for you. They look at it and they go, you know, I don't know who this person is. And they request that that person register. And then once they have registered, then let the person in. But it's kind of like the friends and family plan to some degree as well. And it always involves the first message you send to a person being bounced back, a delay happening, and then the person getting it later.
Well, that's what's great.
Well, my question was more infrastructure in the sense that in order to be a legitimate email, it would have to have a legitimate return path.
Right. What you're
talking
about.
I understand that that's difficult because of the ways that people use disposable addresses.
Well, not so much that. Some of it has to do with adding in, like you said, that caller ID, that reference back to yourself. And that's handled by a sender policy framework. SPF is one of the more common ones. Except the problem with that is it works by how many people get involved with it. So if more companies don't get involved with it, then it doesn't take off. Luckily, AOL, Earthlink, a few large carriers have adopted SPF.
Well, I'll jump in a little bit here and say that SPF is nice. However, the only thing that it protects you against is forged sender addresses.
Right.
Now, these days, it's tremendously easy for spammers to register lots of legitimate domains and set up proper SPF records for those domains that say, yes, these are valid IP addresses to send me email. And so what actually seems to be happening is, even though SPF is a very good idea in avoiding the potential for forged sender addresses, the fact that they can register so many and then send mail from them legitimately with records that even say it's legitimate, really what people are finding is that actually more spammers are adopting SPF records than non-spammers because of that.
So the basic premise, it's to some degree, it is like your caller ID. It's just that you're not, I mean, the thing is would be wonderful about this is, in combination with having a very restricted list of who you want to have call you. So in the phone world, I'm going to have to turn you, one of you that's online on the phone with us has actually turned up the radio or something's going on. In any case, the issue with this kind of technique is, on a phone situation, what you have is a caller ID. You decide to pick it up or not pick it up because you're not necessarily sure what that, you know, Jones is. Maybe it's something legitimate. So you let your answer machine take it. If it's not legitimate, they normally hang up. They don't record the message on the answer machine, so you know that it's fake. If it's real, they normally leave a message. So you've got a second level. An email situation, what are you going to do? You're going to get the message. You're not sure if you know you want to answer it or not, so then you store it so that you can look at it later, and you're still looking at the spam. So it doesn't really defeat that whole issue with spam unless you have a very restrictive policy of saying, if I don't know who this person is, I'm going to delete this email. And that's a situation in which this new way of registering
spam. That's where black hole lists actually come into play, is that they track
email addresses that get
people
forged.
There are a group of people that send spam the most,
right?
Spam groups, and so they actually watch to see if they've registered any domains.
And that would technically work. But there's a lot of ways to get cheap and free email addresses, and you can automate the process as well. So that's why that technology, that way of doing it, doesn't exactly work. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're going to take our next call right away. Going to Santa Cruz. John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks a lot. My question is about protocols. It seems to me that, and I'm totally baffled by this, and I'm glad you guys are doing this topic, because I'm sure I'll get some answers now, but I'm amazed that with all this money spent and all this arms race stuff, that we don't just change the protocol to make spamming impossible. And it seems to me that that's something that's possible now with, like, you know, there's the idea of making, before you send an email, your computer has to do 1 second of processing time, you know, to solve a math problem or something. And so then normal people can send out emails, but if you try to send a million of them, you'd spend a million seconds doing a million math problems or those kinds of things. Is it not true that that's something that we could implement? Is it just kind of momentum, or, you know, could there be something where we put a new protocol and they overlap for a year, and then they say, okay, at the end of this year, this old protocol is going out, and you got to do everything on the new protocol? So that's my question.
Okay, thank you. Stay online with us. Either of you accept it, Miles.
Evan,
or
would you like to take this one?
Yeah, I'll take it. You can always change the protocol. The issue is you have to have a good methodology behind the protocol that's going to solve the problem you're trying to solve. The problem is, right now, is, you know, one of the big problems in the past was forged email addresses. Well, SPF kind of takes care of that. Now we're having problems where it's not forged, it's just registered to real spammer domains. So the problem is that in order to combat spam, you have to come up with a way to cost spammers money to send the stuff that they want to send. And the only real way you can do that is if you start making it, you know, technologically expensive or financially expensive. Graylisting and filtering and all of these other things make it technologically expensive. You know, adopting some other form of, you know, sending mail, like adopting the method the U.S. Postal Service uses. They use, you know, you put a stamp on a letter and you say, yes, this is something that is worth my money for you to receive. The problem is, in email, there's not really an equivalent for that. Now, if you can come up and get somebody to adopt something saying, okay, every time I want to send an email to somebody, I'm going to send them 5 cents or something like that, well, that would make it expensive. But it would also mean that a lot of other people who run things like free emailing lists and stuff like that, where people want the mail, would then be subjected to having to pay in some financial form for that service. And the problem is that no one has really yet come up with a good method of blocking the spam technologically without implementing some other draconian measure like that, where you implement, you know, a sender pays type of situation on top of the email transaction.
Yeah. But who wants to pay for spam? I mean, who wants to pay for email? I mean, just...
Well, what about the 1 second processing time per message idea?
Well, this is I'd actually like to interject here, where it's a case of right now, if everyone implemented all the things you can do with the existing mail protocol for stopping spam, we'd be doing a lot better. One of the problems in getting those new technologies and one of the big barriers to replacing it with a new protocol, like you're suggesting, is getting everyone to agree on it, agree on using it. Because if we don't all agree, then we can't all get email.
And there's competing ways of doing this. Microsoft has a solution. Other groups have solutions on how to fight this problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so some of it isn't technical. Some of it's a social problem.
Okay, so the 1 second delay thing, you're asking me the 1 second delay. First, you can't put that on the client side. You can't put that on the person's computer to do 1 second processing, because if you do that, the person can just write an application that won't do that. So it's not, I mean, you could implement something in such that you send a message to your SMTP server saying, I'm about to send a message, and you have to wait a few seconds before you then send it. So you could add that kind of complexity in the protocol.
Right.
But we got to remember that doing that, for example, wouldn't really do much, because if the delaying practice works in a situation where you know that the load is light. But for massive SMTP service, anytime you delay the process, you're dealing with a really bad problem. They can't have. It takes a lot of equipment, a lot of technology to make that delay work. And you've got to remember that anytime you're doing a delay like that, it's just a matter of time before someone builds a bigger network that can do a delay like that. So you're still going to do a war, if you will.
Not only that, but if the delay scheme was implemented, you have to do that at the server. And the server might say, well, I'm going to delay for a certain amount of time every email that's sent to me, but the same client computer that's sending email can connect to thousands of different servers at the same time. And if it only has to wait, you know, a few seconds for each email message to each single server, that's not going to do anything.
Yeah. I mean, there is an idea that an SMTP server, when it receives messages, it could wait, let's say, 30 seconds. The thing is...
Actually, 20.
20 seconds, yeah. Let's say. But that's part of the spec, that you're supposed to wait that long. But I was speaking to Evan Harris before, our guest, the show. He said, well, actually, large systems do have to wait that long. So spammers already will wait that long. So it's not a good way of going. Evan, can you clarify that a little bit more?
The way that they get around it is exactly what I was explaining, which is that rather than they know that they're going to have some inherent transaction time spent on delivering a single email. And the way they get around that is they do thousands of emails at the same time to different systems. And so adding a delay like that, while it might catch some of the lower-end spammer software, the software just keeps getting better. So I wouldn't expect that something like that would work. First of all, I don't think it would work very well right now, even though it may work partially.
Right.
But I don't expect that it would last very long, because email volumes are steadily increasing, which means that on, you know, servers that are running on the same hardware, they're getting increasingly slower.
John, thank you very much for the call. Wonderful call.
Okay.
And Gene, prior to that, great call as well. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the phone numbers are open. Phone lines are open. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, those numbers we're opening up today for spam and email-related questions and comments. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're talking to Evan Harris. Evan Harris is the author of The Next Step in Spam Control War, Gray Listing. He wrote that article in August 2003, and it is still a functional way to combat spam. So my next question, Evan, and maybe Miles and Sean, why is it that our ISPs aren't doing this stuff?
Well, I would say that there are quite a few ISPs that are doing this sort of thing. One drawbacks, I'll talk about gray listing specifically, I mean, versus other methods. One of the drawbacks of gray listing specifically is that it adds some time delay to email. And when you're dealing with emails that are, say, in a financial business or in a real estate business or something where timeliness is important, or airline industries, whatever, mm-hmm. if time is important for your delivery of email, adding something like gray listing on the front of it is really a pretty unacceptable penalty for those sectors of business.
Right.
So, like a lot of the ISPs, they don't want to be able to say, well, every time somebody sends you a new email, you won't get it for 15 or 20 minutes, you know, until the server retries.
Well, what is the delay like for these things?
Well, that's the little bit difficult thing. The delay is actually dependent on two factors. It's dependent on how much you delay it in gray listing, but it is also dependent on how often the sending server retries. And that's the thing that you can't predict. You don't know how that server was set up. Some servers do every 5 minutes.
And this is why you recommend to use graylisting, have blacklist and whitelist as well for for email servers. So then when a message is coming from AOL.com spam email SMTP servers, you say accept it because they're not going to allow any spam into their system in the first place. Is that the kind of idea you're talking about?
Well, not necessarily. For one thing, it's not really fair to even, for AOL, I mean, AOL sends tons of spam. The problem is the people that do it either get in and get out fast enough that AOL doesn't have time to react, in which case gray listing is helpful. Mm-hmm. That would be another reason why gray listing would help, is like if you have a time delay, the administrators at AOL can realize that all of these queued messages were sent from a spamming account and delete them before they ever get out of their system.
Right. Okay, that's cool. We're going to go to Scotts Valley and take a call from Jeff. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I had just an idea a minute ago. I was wondering if there would be some way to implement something similar to an analog to a deposit bottle scheme. In other words, if normal email users or anybody would have to put some money up front every time they sent an email, and there would be some mechanism on the receiving end that the recipient, you know, if acknowledged that somehow this was a trusted source or a friend or whatever, there'd be some mechanism by which that, you know, that money would be credited back to the sender.
Well, I'll jump in on this. There have been a lot of proposals along that line of thought. The problem is getting everyone to agree with it, and two, how to technically accomplish it. The problem mm-hmm. is, you need, in order to do that, you basically need some form of micropayment system, and there aren't really any widely adopted systems for doing that right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got two hurdles there. You've got to do the micropayment system and get everybody to agree to charge X amount for an email,
mm-hmm.
And enforcing that. The other thing is why a lot of people are not happy with going with that solution is because there are a lot of people that run free email lists that disseminate information to large groups of people, where if they were charged, say, 3 cents or a cent for every email they sent, you know, if they have 10,000 subscribers and they have traffic of 10 messages a day, that adds up to real money.
But if you're in a situation where, I mean, I think that the idea of the deposit idea, Jeff, is intelligent in that when a message succeeds, you don't pay for it. It's only when the person thinks it's spam that you pay for it. That's the general concept, Jeff?
That's true, but there will always be some number of people that might sign up for an email list and then just collect all of the money, you know?
Right.
And you have to have also some way that the people are going to verify that it's something that they wanted.
Yeah.
And adding all of that, you know, complexity on the back end, that has to be done in client-side software, and the users have to be willing to do it, and
right.
a lot of them aren't.
Yeah, Jeff, then you have to trust the client software.
That's right.
Jeff, thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thanks, guys.
The lines are open. You're welcome to call in with spam or email-related questions. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
I do have to say, after setting up the gray list on the GeekSpeak server and now having so few spam emails, before it was always like the defensive front, like how do I stop more spam from coming in, and now I have this breather. I almost feel like going on the offensive, like doing the well, like setting up, for example, the tier grubbing, which is that pause when you when the connection comes in before you actually start answering, that 20-second pause. Which, by the way, you can have multiple 20-second pauses, one after the hello, then one after the mail from, mm-hmm. then one after the RCPT2. And setting it up so that if I see someone coming in, for example, they come in through a black hole list, to actually set them up that, oh, you're a black hole list, I'm not going to drop your connection, I'm going to leave it open and dangle, you know, it's
because
going to go
wrong. We have the processing time. It doesn't cost a lot, if you will, on our little box. To
right,
take
but if enough people did this, then suddenly the spammers have all these open sockets available and it's taking up resources on their system. It will slow them down.
Evan, what do you think about that kind of offensive attack, you know, attacking spammers?
I still don't really consider that to be offensive, or because all...
Well, on the offense, yeah.
I meant offense.
Well, that's what I meant.
Okay.
But you're not really doing anything to attack them. You're just kind of, you know, fending it off in some way still. You know, the problem is there's not really any good way to go on the offensive with these with the spammers, because it's basically hacking if you were to do, like, send them a denial of service back, right, which is something that a couple of, you know, companies have been, I think it was Yahoo or I don't remember, somebody sent out some software that that they invited people to install, and when it detected spammer connections coming in, then it would launch a denial of service attack against the sender. And those kind of things, they're basically illegal.
And they destroy a lot of resources. They burn up resources on the network.
That's right. And in a lot of cases, they're attacking a computer that has virus or malware installed on it, and the user doesn't even know.
Right. Miles, you want to talk
about that? Yeah, I guess that was something I had forgotten about. It isn't the traditional time anymore where the spammer sets up their own mail server to send out. It's mostly zombie PCs and the like now.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's still something that they can look at. As a matter of fact, there was an interesting project that I forget the name of right now that I think I saw last year sometime that basically adds, it doesn't do anything, it doesn't require anything on the mail server side. What it does is it puts bandwidth limiting on the actual network connection.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it then at the router or the firewall. And there's things that will go and you send a message saying, okay, this IP address is sending us spam, and it will actually throttle it down to one character a second.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's a tar pit scheme. And there's a lot of those out there. The problem is, you know, it does take some resources on the receiving server, and, you know, you have a lot more connections that you have to keep track of because you're actually dealing with them.
For spam fighting, it does seem like this, you know, we do one thing, they do something, fight kind of thing. Do you see a situation in which we don't have this dilemma anymore? Or is it just the part of the idea of free information?
I think it's kind of systemic in the fact that we believe, where we're a culture that believes in free association and free dissemination of information. And, you know, as long as people, this is basically, you go back all the way to the physical world where people stood, you know, on a soapbox in a park and, you know, discussed, you know, and orated about the details of some idea they had on a political idea or a sociological issue. And this is, email is just the electronic equivalent of that. The problem is that now the world is within earshot of that person. And there's no real way to throttle it back without also throttling back the ability of people to freely communicate.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. It's part of our society. All right, we're going to take a call from Santa Cruz. Jackie, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello?
Hello, Jackie. Yes, you're on.
Yes, hi. I didn't hear all your program. I hope I'm not repeating. But I'm on some list that I get stuff every day and have to deal with it, and it says if you want off the list, go to this address or send an email to this address, and then it's blank, and then below that there's a whole bunch of gibberish that's probably to defy the spam filters, and I don't know what to do. It's made me really afraid to respond to any kind of email unless I really know the organization or person.
Yeah.
And is there any way out?
No.
Unfortunately, there's not really. One of the laws enacted by Congress to the UCE, or sorry, I'm sorry, I forget the acronym for the law. Miles, do you know
the CAN-SPAM?
Yeah, CAN-SPAM, that's it. The CAN-SPAM Act that they enacted requires several things of people sending email. Well, one of which is that they provide a method to get out of the list. Well, what the spammers actually do is if you click on one of those links, a lot of times rather than taking you off the list, that confirms to them, hey, this is a good email address that people actually read. we're going to add them to more lists so they get more spam because they're obviously paying attention.
Great.
And that's the thing that you're getting around. The law says they're not allowed to do that. But, you know, a lot of people sending this stuff either are overseas or are using servers that are overseas and therefore are not restricted by that.
Is there a way to forward my message to some government authority that'll get them?
Well, you can try. The easiest thing to do is to send it back to abuse at whatever the domain is that sent it. And the problem is that you also have to discern what the actual real domain that sent it is, whether it was forged or not. And sometimes that's a little bit difficult to do unless you actually have log files from the mail server that say where the mail really came from.
So basically you as an end user can't do it.
Oh.
Or you can if you have sufficient knowledge, but it takes a fair amount of background to actually look at the message and see, make sure that you're not putting yourselves on other lists by clicking on the link that takes you to the website that would let you know. It's kind of a catch-22 on all ends.
This is exactly the reason why new techniques that we learn about are so exciting, because it is such a problem, Jackie, to deal with this. There's one solution that works relatively well, actually, and that is to change your email address. So you get together all the people that you ever want to be able to contact you, make sure you understand all the accounts that you have online that are associated with that old email address. You get a new email address, and you wait a month and slowly, you know, filter through the old email address and make sure that only people that you want to receive emails from have the new email address, and then you stop using the old one. That works for a period of time.
And then make sure you don't publish your email address on any web pages.
Yeah. Or use it for any discriminating services.
Would I have to change servers to do that, or how would I do that?
No, most ISPs would let you change the email address or get a second email address. For that matter, it's always getting...
Like call my provider or something?
Yeah, that or you could always get like a Yahoo account or a Gmail account.
And that's one way of doing it if you're really frustrated with it. The other way to do it is contact the person that does your ISP, the person that's managing your accounts for email, the company that you're paying for, basically, and tell them that you want them to implement Evan Harris's idea on gray listing.
Or any number of other ideas which are also useful in combating the problem. But as far as this specific mail that you're having problem with right now, you can also contact the administrator of your mail system and ask them to block mail from that site, which they may be willing to do if you can demonstrate that it was an actual problem. And he may be willing to follow up with it with the ISP of the sender and try and get them thrown off. That's actually how a lot of the blacklist organizations work, is that if they block email from a set of IP addresses, they have a problem called collateral damage, which is basically when they block the IP address of a server that's sending spam, but there are legitimate users that also are using that server. And what they usually end up doing is they will get the ISP to cancel the account of the person who's sending the spam so that they can get off the blacklist. And that's really the best thing to do, is make it difficult, make it painful for the spammer. And the easiest way to do that is to cancel their account. And go, but in order to do that, you have to be dealing with an ISP that's actually interested in that. Whereas some of the ISPs are more interested in getting the money from the spammer than protecting you.
So Jackie, we're running out of time. Unfortunately, you're welcome to send us an email. Go to geekspeak.org. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, earlier in the show, we had Drew Meyer. We have Sean Cleveland stayed the entire time. Miles Elam, who brought this whole idea of gray listing to my attention, implemented on our server, and is now my new hero, along with our guest, Evan Harris, who wrote the white paper, The Next Steps in Spam Control War, Gray Listing.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Evan. You've changed my experience online using email.
You're very welcome. If I can, I'd like to go ahead and give the URL
Please
to the
do.
White paper so that people can see it. If you go to projects.puremagic.com/graylisting, GREYLISTING. Or if you do a search for gray listing on Google, you will probably find the page as one of the first couple of links, and you'll be able to find a lot more information about gray listing specifically, as well as links to some other projects.
Thank you very much, Evan Harris.
Thank you.
Community Alliance with Family Farmers provided a grant for this program. Buying fresh and local produce from farmers markets, CSAs, retailers, and restaurants supports the local economy. For information about the Buy Fresh, Buy Local campaign, 761-8507 or online at caff.org.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Now some NPR News.
NPR News in Washington. I'm Lakshmi Singh. The search is underway for a new Supreme Court nominee after Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announced today she was resigning. The White House is compiling a list of potential candidates to succeed O'Connor, the first woman to be appointed to the nation's highest court. President Bush says he'll move quickly.
I will choose a nominee in a timely manner so that the hearing and the vote can be completed before the new Supreme Court term begins.
Debates expected to heat up among congressional